Now that you have decided to deepen in the writings of Baha'u'llah, this window from these windows to the past might be a helpful beginning. It will open to the explanations by Mr. Adib Taharzadeh about two well-known books revealed by Baha'u'llah, namely, the Book of Certitude, or the Kitab-e-Iqan, and the Hidden Words. The depth and knowledge of Mr. Taharzadeh needs no introduction, as they are manifest in his writings. Mr. Taharzadeh, presently a member of the Universal House of Justice, and the author of The Revelation of Baha'u'llah in 4 volumes, as well as The Covenant of Baha'u'llah, has graciously consented to the narration of chapters 6 and 10 of volume 1 of The Revelation of Baha'u'llah. Minimal editing has been done. On behalf of ourselves and many who might otherwise miss his excellent exposition, we wish to extend our deep appreciation to him.
Circumstances of the Revelation of the Kitab-e-Iqan. In the whole range of Baha'u'llah's writings, the Kitab-e-Iqan, or the Book of Certitude, has most importance, with the exception of the Kitab-e-Aqdas, or the Most Holy Book. It was revealed in Baghdad about 2 years before his declaration, in honor of Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad, the Bab's maternal uncle. The Bab had 3 maternal uncles. The first to embrace his faith was Haji Mirza Sayyid Ali, known as Khali Azam, meaning the greatest uncle. It was he who cared for the Bab, and after the passing of his father, was responsible for bringing up. Haji Mirza Sayyid Ali became aware of the spiritual qualities and superhuman powers which his nephew manifested from an early age. He readily recognized the station of the Bab and became an ardent believer as soon as he became acquainted with his claim. Indeed, next to the letters of the living, he was the first person in Shiraz to acknowledge the divine origin of the message of the Bab, and from then on, he devoted his life entirely to the promotion of the newly born faith and the protection of its youthful founder. A few months before the martyrdom of the Bab, he was arrested, and upon refusing to recant his faith, was publicly martyred. He is one of the 7 martyrs of Tehran. The eldest uncle, Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad, although fully aware of the outstanding qualities of his nephew, was not converted to his faith until he met Baha'u'llah in Baghdad and received the Kitab-e-Iqan in answer to his questions. The third uncle was Haji Mirza Hasan Ali. For some years, Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad, the eldest uncle, carried out his business as a merchant away from home in Bushehr in association with his brother Haji Mirza Sayyid Ali and his nephew the Bab. When these two, meaning the Bab and his uncle who raised him, left for Shiraz, he continued to work on his own and was still in Bushehr when the Bab declared his mission to his first disciples. Later, when the Bab made his pilgrimage to Mecca, he, meaning the Bab, traveled by way of Bushehr, where he stayed at the home of Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad, the eldest uncle. He returned there some months later while journeying back to Shiraz. It was during these visits that Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad witnessed a transformation of spirit in the Bab and wrote about it to his own mother and sister, who was the mother of the Bab, in these words. Quote, "His Eminence Janabi Haji," referring to the Bab, "has safely arrived and I am pleased to spend my time in his presence. It seems advisable that he should stay in Bushehr for a short while. But please rest assured that soon he will depart for home. Truly, his bountiful soul is the source of felicity for the people of this world and the next. He brings honor to us all." End quote. Yet, in spite of these remarks and of his unfailing admiration and respect for the Bab, Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad did not recognize his station for many years and remained uncommitted to his cause. In the meantime, the martyrdom of the Bab and his illustrious uncle in 1850 brought immense grief and shock to all the members of the family. The Bab's mother, Fatima Begum, who could no longer bear to live in her home in Shiraz, took up residence in far-off Iraq in the city of Karbala to be near the shrine of Imam Hussein. Until the time Baha'u'llah arrived in Iraq after his imprisonment in the Siyahchal and established contact with her, she remained unaware of the significance of the message of the Bab. It was Baha'u'llah who arranged for Haji Sayyid Javad Karbala'i, one of the distinguished early disciples of the Bab, accompanied by a devoted believer, the wife of a certain Sheikh Abdul Majid Shirazi, to meet with the mother of the Bab and demonstrate to her the truth of the mission of her illustrious son. This contact established by Baha'u'llah brought forth a wonderful response. Her soul was quickened, and the glory of the new faith of God founded by the Bab was unveiled before her eyes. Later she recognized the station of Baha'u'llah, embraced his faith, and remained steadfast till the end of her life. Although several of the Bab's kinsmen, including his wife, had accepted the faith during the early days of his ministry, and thousands of his followers had laid down their lives in his path, nevertheless, Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad was not absolutely convinced that the Bab, his nephew, could be the promised one of Islam. Several believers tried to dispel his doubts, but their efforts did not win him over. Haji Mirza Habibullah, an Afnan, who was one of the custodians of the house of the Bab in Shiraz, has recorded the following account by his father, Agha Mirza Nuruddin, a follower of the Bab, of a series of discussions which he held with Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad. These discussions appear to have been a turning point in the spiritual life of the Bab's uncle. Quote, "During the initial stages of our discussions, Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad maintained a negative attitude and would repudiate any proof or argument that I put forward. These discussions lasted for several meetings. Once, when I was talking with great fervor and conviction about the faith, he turned to me in astonishment and exclaimed, 'Are you really saying that my nephew is the promised Qa'im?' When I reaffirmed my belief that he was, Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad became perplexed and expressed his view that this was all very strange. He then began to meditate and was lost in thoughts. Seeing him in this reflective mood, I could not prevent myself from laughing. He asked my reason for laughing, but as it would reflect badly upon him, I was reluctant to tell. However, he insisted. So I told him, 'Your view that your nephew cannot be the promised Qa'im is similar to the objection which Abu Lahab had.' Abu Lahab was an uncle of Muhammad who refused to acknowledge his prophethood and was hostile to him. Abu Lahab also said, 'How could it be possible for my nephew to become a prophet? But Muhammad was the true prophet of God. Now it is up to you to investigate this cause. You must be very proud that this son of truth has dawned from your family and its light shone forth from your home. Do not hold back from it, and be not surprised, for God is able to make of your nephew the promised one of Islam. Be assured that the hands of God are never tied. Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad was moved by these words. He said, "This is an irrefutable answer. Now what shall I do?" I suggested to him that he might go as a pilgrim to the holy shrines in Iraq, where he could also visit his sister, the mother of the Bab, who had been living there since the martyrdom of her son, and then go to Baghdad, attain the presence of Baha'u'llah, ask his questions of him, and put forward his difficulties. I urged him to persevere in his search and to rely upon God. I expressed the hope that the veil which now prevented him from seeing the truth might be lifted from his eyes and that he might attain the true faith of God. He agreed to my suggestions and said that he felt in his heart that this was the right course to take. End quote. Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad thereupon wrote a letter to his youngest brother, Haji Mirza Hasan Ali, who was a merchant in Yazd, acquainted him with his plan to visit the shrines and their sister, and invited him to join him in the journey. Haji Mirza Hasan Ali accepted and asked his brother to wait until he joined him in Shiraz. They both traveled to Iraq via Bushehr. Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad, however, did not intimate the real purpose of his journey to his brother until they arrived in Baghdad. There he informed him that his primary object of traveling to Iraq was to investigate the authenticity of the faith and then to visit shrines and the mother of the Bab. He invited his brother to remain in Baghdad for a short period so they both could attain the presence of Baha'u'llah and afterwards proceed to visit the shrines. On hearing this, Haji Mirza Hasan Ali became angry, and although his junior in age, he spoke harshly to his brother. He warned that under no circumstances would he become partner in these matters, and that he did not wish to hear about the faith. On that day he left Baghdad. When this happened, Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad decided to accompany his brother to the shrines. It was on his return to Baghdad that he was taken to the house of Baha'u'llah, where he attained his presence alone. This was in the year 1862. Baha'u'llah's amanuensis, Mirza Agha Jan, has described the circumstances which led to the revelation of the Kitab-e-Iqan in a tablet addressed to Sheikh Abdul Majid Shirazi. He says that one day Haji Sayyid Jawad Karbalai went to Baha'u'llah and informed him that two uncles of the Bab, having visited the holy shrines in Najaf and Karbala, were now in Baghdad and would be returning home soon. Having ascertained from Haji Sayyid Jawad that he had not discussed the faith with them, Baha'u'llah lovingly admonished him for not being engaged in the teaching of the cause. He then instructed him to invite the two brothers to come to his presence. The next day, Haji Sayyid Jawad arrived with the uncle of the Bab, Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad. The youngest brother did not come. The utterances of Baha'u'llah uplifted and overwhelmed the Bab's uncle as he sat in his presence. At the end, he begged Baha'u'llah to clarify the truth of the Bab's message, bearing in mind that in his view, some of the traditions of Islam concerning the promised Qa'im were apparently not fulfilled by his nephew. To this, Baha'u'llah readily consented. He bade him go home and, after careful consideration, make a list of all questions which had puzzled him and all the traditions which had bred doubts in his mind, and to bring these to him. The following day, Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad arrived with his questions. Within the span of 2 days and two nights, the Kitab-e-Iqan, a lengthy epistle of over 200 pages, dealing with all his questions, was revealed by Baha'u'llah. In the early days, this book was known as Risale-i-Khal, meaning the epistle to the uncle. But later Baha'u'llah designated it as the Kitab-e-Iqan.
Among the papers which are preserved in the family of the Afnan are the questions which Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad presented to Baha'u'llah. They are written on two sheets in his own hand and are under four headings, all dealing with the coming of the promised Qa'im. The sincerity of the uncle of the Bab in seeking the truth is evident in his questions. Repeatedly, he begs Baha'u'llah to dispel his doubts, so that his heart may be assured and he may acquire absolute faith and certitude in the cause of the Bab. Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad was so affected by meeting Baha'u'llah that he immediately wrote a letter to his son, Haji Mirza Muhammad Taghi, in which he said, quote, "I attained the presence of His Honor Baha, may peace be upon him, and I wish you could have been present. He treated me with the utmost affection and favor, and graciously asked me to stay for the night. It is an absolute truth that deprivation from his bounteous presence is a grievous loss. May God bestow upon me the privilege of attaining his presence perpetually." End quote. The Kitab-e-Iqan dispelled every doubt that Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad had harbored in his mind. As a result of reading this book, he reached the stage of certitude and recognized the station of the Bab. In his will, written some years later, he declared his faith, acknowledged the authenticity of the messages of the Bab and Baha'u'llah, and identified himself as a follower of these twin manifestations of God. As to Haji Mirza Sayyid Hassan Ali, the youngest uncle of the Bab, he returned to Yazd without meeting Baha'u'llah. Some years later, however, through the devoted efforts of his wife's brother, he too accepted the faith and remained steadfast throughout his life. Indeed, all the family of the Bab, including his mother, his wife, his uncles, and their children, designated as Afnan, embraced the faith. This was actually prophesied by the Bab himself, for he had said that God, through his bounty, would guide all his family to recognize the truth of his cause. The original copy of the Kitab-e-Iqan, which Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad received, was transcribed by Abdu'l-Bahá, who was then 18 years of age. In the margins of a few pages, Baha'u'llah has, in his own hand, made some corrections, and towards the end of the book has written this passage, quote, "Amidst them all we stand, life in hand, wholly resigned to His will, that, perchance through God's loving kindness and His grace, this revealed and manifest letter may lay down His life as a sacrifice in the path of the primal point, the most exalted word. By Him at whose bidding the Spirit hath spoken, but for this yearning of our soul, we would not for one moment have tarried any longer in this city. Sufficient witness is God unto us." End quote. For many years, this original copy of the Kitab-e-Iqan remained with the family of Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad until in 1948 his great-granddaughter, Fatime Hanome Afnan, presented it to Shoghi Effendi, the guardian of the faith. It reached him a few years later and was placed in the Baha'i International Archives building on Mount Carmel, Haifa. The importance of the Kitab-e-Iqan. Perhaps it can be said that the Kitab-e-Iqan was more widely disseminated among the early believers in Persia than any other writing of Baha'u'llah. In those days, the only way of making the holy writings available to the friends was by transcribing them. As new tablets would arrive, the believers were most anxious to make copies for themselves. Copies of several of these tablets were often assembled and bound as a book. There are many such volumes of handwritten compilations of the tablets of the Bab, Baha'u'llah, and Abdu'l-Bahá in the possession of Baha'i families, who have inherited them from their forebears and to whom they are very precious. There were also some individuals in Persia whose full-time occupation was the transcription of the writings, and the believers used to obtain their copies from them. The Kitab-e-Iqan was one of the items which kept these men transcribing for many years in order to cope with the demand. From the literary point of view, the Kitab-e-Iqan can be regarded as an outstanding work in Persian literature. Shoghi Effendi, the guardian of the faith, who translated this book superbly into English, has described it in these words, quote, "Foremost among the priceless treasures cast forth from the billowing ocean of Baha'u'llah's revelation ranks the Kitab-e-Iqan, a model of Persian prose, of a style at once original, chaste and vigorous, and remarkably lucid, both cogent in argument and matchless in its irresistible eloquence. This book, setting forth in outline the grand redemptive scheme of God, occupies a position unequaled by any work in the entire range of Baha'i literature, except the Kitab-e Aqdas, Baha'u'llah's most holy book." End quote. Until the Kitab-e-Iqan was revealed, the significance of the missions of all the prophets of God, the purpose of their revelations, and the true meaning of their words had remained undisclosed. With the revelation of this book, the significance of the words, which according to Daniel were closed up and sealed till the time of the end, became apparent. The seal which Providence for thousands of years had placed upon the holy books of all religions was removed. The Kitab-e-Iqan is the best example of how to teach the cause of God. Instead of explaining at once the proofs of the authenticity of the message of the Bab, Baha'u'llah first speaks about other prophets, portrays their lives and their sufferings, demonstrates the truth of their missions, and describes the common features of their faith. In this way, he brings to the understanding of the reader the truth of his own religion and enables him to recognize the reality of his own prophet. Having built this strong foundation, he then, towards the end of the book, speaks of the Bab and his message, and applies to this new revelation the standards he has applied in verifying the truth of other prophets. Since all the manifestations of God derive their authority from the same source, it is therefore possible to know the latest manifestation if one knows the qualities and attributes of one who appeared in a former age. The great majority of the followers of the world's religions, however, are taught to believe only in one messenger of God. While sincere in their belief that their religion is true and divine in origin, they often have not recognized the reality of their own prophet. There is a great deal of difference between having knowledge of a religion and knowing the reality of the founder of one's faith. For example, a man may possess a piece of gold and may know that it is precious, yet be unable to distinguish gold from brass. Such a man will fail to recognize a new piece of gold when he sees it. Such is mankind's condition today. But should anyone recognize the reality of the founder of his own religion, he will have no difficulty in accepting Baha'u'llah as the manifestation of God for this age. The Kitab-e-Iqan has enabled a vast number of people from various backgrounds to understand the truth of their own religions the first step towards believing in Baha'u'llah. This book has shed great luster upon the holy books of past dispensations. It has unfolded the pattern and disclosed the meaning of progressive revelation. It has laid down an enduring foundation for the ultimate unity of all past religions. It has served as a key with which the followers of Baha'u'llah have opened the doors of knowledge hitherto unknown to man. It has become a fountainhead of inspiration for Baha'i scholars and teachers who have since written volumes proving the authenticity of the message of Baha'u'llah by rational and intellectual proofs or by interpretation of past holy scriptures. Indeed, this book has given a new vision to the Baha'is, enabling them to unravel the mysteries of religion and teach their faith with greater insight and knowledge.
Major themes of the Kitab-e-Iran, Part 1. The first thing to bear in mind when studying the Kitab-e-Iran is the fact that Baha'u'llah wrote this book for a man whose background was Muslim. The passages he quoted are often from the Quran or the traditions of Islam. In the opening paragraph, Baha'u'llah has made the recognition of truth conditional upon man's detachment from this world, a point which he stresses throughout the book. These are his words, quote, "No man shall attain the shores of the ocean of true understanding except he be detached from all that is in heaven and on earth." The essence of these words is this: they that tread the path of faith, they that thirst for the wine of certitude, must cleanse themselves of all that is earthly, their ears from idle talk, their minds from vain imaginings, their hearts from worldly affections, their eyes from that which perisheth. They should put their trust in God, and holding fast unto him, follow in his way. Then will they be made worthy of the effulgent glories of the Sun of Divine Knowledge and Understanding, and become the recipient of a grace that is infinite and unseen." End quote. The reasons for man's opposition to the prophets of God. In the first section of the Kitab-e-Iran, Baha'u'llah dwells on the history of the prophets of the past and explains the main reasons for man's opposition to them. By understanding these reasons, one can be guided to recognize the truth of the cause of God in this day. He attaches such importance to this theme that he devotes a considerable portion of the book to it. After describing some of the cruelties and indignities which were heaped upon certain prophets of old, Baha'u'llah remarks, quote, "And now ponder upon these things. What could have caused such contention and conflict? Why is it that the advent of every true manifestation of God had been accompanied by such strife and tumult, by such tyranny and upheaval? This notwithstanding the fact that all the prophets of God, whenever made manifest unto the peoples of the world, have invariably foretold the coming of yet another prophet after them, and have established such signs as would herald the advent of the future dispensation. To this the records of all sacred books bear witness. Why then is it that despite the expectation of men in their quest of the manifestations of holiness, and in spite of the signs recorded in the sacred books, should such acts of violence, of oppression and cruelty have been perpetrated in every age and cycle against all the prophets and chosen ones of God?" End quote. Baha'u'llah then enumerates several causes for man's rejection of the manifestations of God. First among these is the fact that the masses in every age have blindly followed their clergy, who have, for the most part, opposed the new prophet of God. Concerning the religious leaders, Baha'u'llah writes, quote, "Leaders of religion in every age have hindered their people from attaining the shores of eternal salvation, inasmuch as they held the reins of authority in their mighty grasp. Some for the lust of leadership, others through want of knowledge and understanding, have been the cause of the deprivation of the people. By their sanction and authority, every prophet of God had drunk from the chalice of sacrifice and winged his flight unto the heights of glory. What unspeakable cruelties they that have occupied the seats of authority and learning have inflicted upon the true monarchs of the world, those gems of divine virtue. Content with the transitory dominion, they have deprived themselves of an everlasting sovereignty." End quote. Later, in the book, Baha'u'llah condemns the divines for their ignorance and lack of insight. Quote, "Among these are the divines and doctors living in the days of the manifestation of God, who, because of their want of discernment and their love and eagerness for leadership, have failed to submit to the cause of God, nay, have even refused to incline their ears unto the divine melody. They have thrust their fingers into their ears." This is a verse from Quran. "And the people also, utterly ignoring God and taking them for their masters, have placed themselves unreservedly under the authority of these pompous and hypocritical leaders. For they have no sight, no hearing, no heart of their own to distinguish truth from falsehood." End quote. Another cause of man's refusal to accept a new messenger is that he brings new teachings, abrogates the laws of the past, and establishes a new order. This radical change upsets religious leaders, for they see the new message as a challenge to their authority and arise to oppose him with all their power. Another reason for rejecting the new prophet is that in every religion, certain signs are given for the advent of the next manifestation of God. Because man has expected a literal fulfillment of these signs and has failed to understand their true meaning, he has been unable to recognize the new message from God.
The signs of the return of Christ. To elucidate this point, Baha'u'llah devotes no less than 70 pages to the interpretation of one passage from the Gospels, which gives the signs of the return of Christ. In doing so, he also touches upon several other subjects. Concerning the signs of the coming of Christ, he reveals, quote, "Afterwards, the companions and disciples of Jesus asked him concerning those signs that must needs signalize the return of his manifestation. When, they asked, shall these things be? Several times they questioned that peerless beauty, and every time he made reply, he set forth a special sign that should herald the advent of the promised dispensation. To this testify the records of the four Gospels. This wronged one will cite but one of these instances, thus conferring upon mankind for the sake of God such bounties as are yet concealed within the treasury of the hidden and sacred tree, that haply mortal men may not remain deprived of their share of the immortal fruit, and attain to a dewdrop of the waters of everlasting life, which, from Baghdad, the abode of peace, are being vouchsafed unto all mankind. These are the melodies sung by Jesus, son of Mary, in accents of majestic power in the Rezvan of the Gospel, revealing those signs that must needs herald the advent of the manifestation after him. In the first gospel, according to Matthew, it is recorded, "And when they asked Jesus concerning the signs of his coming, he said unto them, Immediately after the oppression of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the earth shall be shaken. And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he shall send his angel with a great sound of a trumpet." Inasmuch as the Christian divines have failed to apprehend the meaning of these words and did not recognize their object and purpose, and have clung to the literal interpretation of the words of Jesus, they therefore became deprived of the streaming grace of the Mohammedan revelation and its showering bounties. End quote. Interpretation of symbolic terms. Baha'u'llah then explains at some length the meaning of these words. Quote, "By oppression is meant the want of capacity to acquire spiritual knowledge and apprehend the word of God. By it is meant that when the day star of truth hath set, and the mirrors that reflect his light have departed, mankind will become afflicted with oppression and hardship, knowing not whither to turn for guidance. Such a condition as this is witnessed in this day, when the reins of every community have fallen into the grasp of foolish leaders, who lead after their own whims and desire. On their tongue the mention of God hath become an empty name, in their midst his holy word a dead letter. Though they recognize in their hearts the law of God to be one and the same, yet from every direction they issue a new command, and in every season proclaim a fresh decree. No two are found to agree on one and the same law, for they seek no God but their own desire, and tread no path but the path of error. With all their power and strength they strive to secure themselves in their petty pursuits, fearful lest the least discredit undermine their authority, or blemish the display of their magnificence. Were the eye to be anointed and illumined with the collyrium of the knowledge of God, it would surely discover that a number of voracious beasts have gathered and preyed upon the carrion of the souls of men. What oppression is greater than that which hath been recounted? What oppression is more grievous than that a soul seeking the truth and wishing to attain unto the knowledge of God should know not where to go for it, and from whom to seek it? For opinions have sorely differed, and the ways unto the attainment of God have multiplied. This oppression is the essential feature of every revelation. Unless it cometh to pass, the Son of Truth will not be made manifest, for the break of the morn of divine guidance must needs follow the darkness of the night of error." End quote. Concerning their words sun and moon, Baha'u'llah states, quote, "By the terms sun and moon mentioned in the writings of the prophets of God is not meant solely the sun and moon of the visible universe. Nay, rather manifold are the meanings they have intended for these terms. In every instance they have attached to them a particular significance. Thus by the sun, in one sense, is meant those sons of truth who rise from the dayspring of ancient glory and fill the world with a liberal effusion of grace from on high. These sons of truth are the universal manifestations of God in the worlds of his attributes and names, even as the visible sun that assisteth, as decreed by God, the true one, the adored, in the development of all earthly things, such as the trees, the fruits, and colors thereof, the minerals of the earth, and all that may be witnessed in the world of creation, so do the divine luminaries, by their loving care and educative influence, cause the trees of divine unity, the fruits of his oneness, the leaves of detachment, the blossoms of knowledge and certitude, and the myrtles of wisdom and utterance to exist and be made manifest. It is the warmth that these luminaries of God generate, and the undying fires they kindle, which cause the light of the love of God to burn fiercely in the heart of humanity. In another sense, by these terms, is intended the divines of the former dispensation, who live in the days of the subsequent revelations, and who hold the reins of religion in their grasp. If these divines be illumined by the light of the latter revelation, they will be acceptable unto God and will shine with a light everlasting. Otherwise they will be declared as darkened, even though to outward seeming they be leaders of men, inasmuch as belief and unbelief, guidance and error, felicity and misery, light and darkness, are all dependent upon the sanction of Him who is the Day-Star of Truth. Whosoever among the divines of every age receiveth in the day of reckoning the testimony of faith from the source of true knowledge, he verily becometh the recipient of learning, of divine favor, and of the light of true understanding. Otherwise he is branded as guilty of folly, denial, blasphemy, and oppression. It is evident and manifest unto every discerning observer that even as the light of the star fadeth before the effulgent splendor of the sun, so doth the luminary of earthly knowledge, of wisdom and understanding, vanish into nothingness when brought face to face with the resplendent glories of the Sun of Truth, the Day Star of Divine Enlightenment. In another sense, by the terms sun, moon, and stars are meant such laws and teachings as have been established and proclaimed in every dispensation, such as the laws of prayer and fasting. Hence, it is clear and manifest that by the words, the sun shall be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, is intended the waywardness of the divines and the annulment of laws firmly established by divine revelation, all of which, in symbolic language, have been foreshadowed by the manifestation of God. It is unquestionable that in every succeeding revelation, the sun and moon of the teachings, laws, commandments, and prohibitions, which have been established in the preceding dispensation, and which have overshadowed the people of that age, become darkened, that is, are exhausted, and cease to exert their influence. End quote.
Concerning the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, Baha'u'llah affirms that this sign is manifest both in the visible and invisible heavens. Before the coming of each prophet, not only has a star appeared in the skies indicating the birth of a new revelation, but a herald has also announced these glad tidings to the people of the age. For example, the soothsayers in the time of Moses warned Pharaoh, quote, "A star hath risen in the heaven, and lo, it foreshadoweth the conception of a child who holdeth your fate and the fate of your people in his hand." In like manner, there appeared a sage who, in the darkness of the night, brought tidings of joy unto the people of Israel, imparting consolation to their souls and assurance to their hearts. End quote. Before the days of the revelation of Christ, a few of the Magi went to Herod and said, "Where is he that is born King of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east, and are come to worship him." This was the sign appearing in the visible heaven. However, it was John the Baptist who was the spiritual star. He foretold the coming of Christ and prepared people for his revelation. Before the advent of Muhammad, also similar events took place. The following are the words of Baha'u'llah concerning those who heralded the Prophet of Islam. Quote, "As to the signs of the invisible heaven, there appeared four men who successively announced unto the people the joyful tidings of the rise of that divine luminary. Ruzbeh, later named Salman, was honored by being in their service. As the end of one of these approached, he would send Ruzbeh unto the other, until the fourth, who feeling his death to be nigh, addressed Ruzbeh, saying, 'O Ruzbeh, when thou hast taken up my body and buried it, go to Hejaz, for there the day star of Muhammad will rise. Happy art you, for thou shalt behold his face.'" End quote. And in this revelation, before the declaration of the Bab, this twofold sign appeared. Baha'u'llah states, quote, "Know thou verily that many an astronomer had announced the appearance of its star in the visible heaven. Likewise, there appeared on earth Ahmad and Qasim, those twin resplendent lights." End quote. Concerning the mourning of the tribes of earth and the coming of the Son of Man in the clouds of heaven, Baha'u'llah writes, quote, "These words signify that in those days men will lament the loss of the Sun of the Divine Beauty, of the Moon of Knowledge, and of the stars of divine wisdom. Thereupon, they will behold the countenance of the Promised One, the adored beauty, descending from heaven and riding upon the clouds. By this is meant that the divine beauty will be made manifest from the heaven of the will of God, and will appear in the form of the human temple. The term heaven denoteth the loftiness and exaltation, inasmuch as it is the seat of the revelation of those manifestations of holiness, the day springs of ancient glory. These ancient beings, though delivered from the womb of their mother, have in reality descended from the heaven of the will of God. Though they be dwelling on this earth, yet their true habitation are the retreats of glory in the realms above. Whilst walking amongst mortals, they soar in the heaven of the divine presence. Without feet, they tread the path of the spirit, and without wings, they rise unto the exalted heights of divine unity. With every fleeting breath, they cover the immensity of space, and at every moment traverse the kingdoms of the visible and the invisible." End quote. As to the meaning of the clouds, Baha'u'llah asserts, quote, "These clouds signify, in one sense, the annulment of laws, the abrogation of former dispensations, the repeal of rituals and customs current amongst men, the exalting of the illiterate faithful above the learned opposers of the faith. In another sense, they mean the appearance of that immortal beauty in the image of mortal man, with such human limitation as eating and drinking, poverty and riches, glory and abasement, sleeping and waking, and such other things has cast doubt in the minds of men and caused them to turn away. All such veils are symbolically referred to as clouds. End quote. Regarding the sending of angels, Baha'u'llah explains that these are holy souls who, quote, have sanctified themselves from every human limitation, have become endowed with the attributes of the spiritual, and have been adorned with the noble traits of the blessed, and they therefore have been designated as angels. In the course of interpreting the aforementioned passage from the Gospel, Baha'u'llah elucidates several other points, throws light on some obscure and hidden words of the prophets, quotes extensively from the Quran and traditions of Islam, and reveals a vast range of new verities which had remained unknown and concealed within all former religions. He explains the meaning of such terms as the changing of the earth, the cleaving of heaven, expected by Islam to happen at the last hour, the day of resurrection, the day when the heaven shall give out a palpable smoke which shall enshroud mankind. He further asserts, quote, were the signs of the manifestations of God in every age to appear in the visible realm in accordance with the text of the established traditions, none could possibly deny or turn away, nor would the blessed be distinguished from the miserable and the transgressor from the God-fearing. Judge fairly, were the prophecies recorded in the Gospel to be literally fulfilled, were Jesus, Son of Mary, accompanied by angels, to descend from the visible heaven upon the clouds, who would dare to disbelieve? Who would dare to reject the truth and wax disdainful? Nay, such consternation would immediately seize all the dwellers of the earth that no soul would feel able to utter a word, much less to reject or accept the truth. End quote.
Further reasons for man's rejection of the prophets. The reason that people have not understood the meaning of the signs given in the holy books is that they have blindly followed their religious leaders. Baha'u'llah confirms this in the Kitab-e-Iqan in these words, quote, such objections and differences have persisted in every age and century. The people have always busied themselves with such specious discourses, vainly protesting, wherefore hath not this or that sign appeared? Such ills befell them only because they have clung to the ways of the divines of the age in which they lived, and blindly imitated them in accepting or denying these essences of detachment, these holy and divine beings. These leaders, owing to their immersion in selfish desires and their pursuit of transitory and sordid things, have regarded these divine luminaries as being opposed to the standards of their knowledge and understanding, and the opponents of their ways and judgments. As they have literally interpreted the Word of God and the sayings and traditions of the Letters of Unity, and expounded them according to their own deficient understanding, they have therefore deprived themselves and all their people of the bountiful showers of the grace and mercies of God. End quote. To understand the mysteries enshrined in God's religion, Baha'u'llah repeatedly states man must cleanse his heart from all earthly things. Here is one passage, quote, wert thou to cleanse the mirror of thy heart from the dust of malice, thou wouldst apprehend the meaning of the symbolic terms revealed by the all-embracing Word of God made manifest in every dispensation, and wouldst discover the mysteries of divine knowledge. Not, however, until thou consumest with the flame of utter detachment those veils of idle learning that are current amongst men, canst thou behold the resplendent morn of true knowledge. Know verily that knowledge is of two kinds, divine and satanic. The one welleth out from the fountain of divine inspiration, the other is but a reflection of vain and obscure thoughts. The source of the former is God himself, the motive force of the latter, the whisperings of selfish desire. The one is guided by the principle, "Fear ye God, God will teach you." The other is but a confirmation of the truth. Knowledge is the most grievous veil between man and his Creator. The former bringeth forth the fruit of patience, of longing desire, of true understanding and love, whilst the latter can yield naught but arrogance, vainglory, and conceit. From the sayings of those masters of holy utterance who have expounded the meaning of true knowledge, the odor of these dark teachings which have obscured the world can in no wise be detected. The tree of such teachings can yield no result except iniquity and rebellion, and beareth no fruit but hatred and envy. Its fruit is deadly poison, its shadow a consuming fire. End quote. Another important factor which has hindered recognition of the manifestations of God is the tests which are associated with their revelations. In each case, certain events in the life of the manifestation have acted as stumbling blocks to people, preventing them from recognizing the truth. Concerning this, Baha'u'llah has revealed these words, quote, "Know verily that the purpose underlying all these symbolic terms and abstruse allusions which emanate from the revealers of God's holy cause hath been to test and prove the peoples of the world, that thereby the earth of the pure and illuminated hearts may be known from the perishable and barren soil. From time immemorial such hath been the way of God amidst his creatures, and to this testify the records of the sacred books." End quote. He demonstrates this important principle by giving a few examples. Speaking of Muhammad, who used to face Jerusalem while leading his followers in prayer, Baha'u'llah recounts this story of his sudden turning towards the holy mosque, Mecca. Quote, "When the prophet, together with his companions, was offering the noontide prayer, the voice of Gabriel was heard, 'Turn thou thy face towards the sacred mosque.' In the midst of that same prayer, Muhammad suddenly turned his face away from Jerusalem and faced the Kaaba, whereupon a profound dismay seized suddenly the companions of the prophet. Their faith was shaken severely. So great was their alarm that many of them, discontinuing their prayer, apostatized their faith. Verily, God caused not this turmoil but to test and prove his servants. Yea, such things as throw consternation into the hearts of all men come to pass only that each soul may be tested by the touchstone of God, that the true may be known and distinguished from the false." End quote. Yet another story mentioned by Baha'u'llah in illustration of this theme concerns Moses. Quote, "For instance, consider Moses. Whilst passing one day ere his ministry was proclaimed, he saw two men engaged in fighting. One of them asked the help of Moses against his opponent, whereupon Moses intervened and slew him. And now ponder in thy heart the commotion which God stirreth up. Reflect upon the strange and manifold trials with which he doth test his servants. Consider how he hath suddenly chosen from among his servants, and entrusted with the exalted mission of divine guidance, him who was known as guilty of homicide, who himself had acknowledged his cruelty, and who for well nigh 30 years had in the eyes of the world been reared in the home of Pharaoh and been nourished at his table. Was not God, the omnipotent King, able to withhold the hand of Moses from murder, so that manslaughter should not be attributed unto him, causing bewilderment and aversion among the people? End quote. Mankind was similarly tested when Christ appeared, but on that occasion, the circumstances of his birth were the test, as Baha'u'llah explains. Quote, likewise reflect upon the state and condition of Mary. So deep was the perplexity of that most beauteous countenance, so grievous her case, that she bitterly regretted she had ever been born. Reflect, what answer could Mary have given to the people around her? How could she claim that a babe whose father was unknown had been conceived of the Holy Ghost? Therefore did Mary, that veiled and immortal countenance, take up her child and return unto her home. And now meditate upon this most great convulsion, this grievous test. Notwithstanding all these things, God conferred upon that essence of the Spirit, who was known amongst the people as fatherless, the glory of prophethood, and made him his testimony unto all that are in heaven and on earth. End quote.
Major Themes, Part 2. The Nature of God and His Manifestations. Having clearly demonstrated some of the causes which have prevented men from recognizing the messengers of God, Baha'u'llah begins the second part of the Kitab-e-Iqan with one of the most illuminating passages revealed by him concerning the nature of the manifestation and his relationship to God and man. In the following words he states, most eloquently, that man shall never of himself be able to know his Creator, but by his bounty God reveals himself through a prophet in each age. Quote, to every discerning and illumined heart, it is evident that God, the unknowable essence, the divine being, is immensely exalted beyond every human attribute, such as corporeal existence, ascent and descent, egress and regress. Far be it from his glory that human tongue should adequately recount his praise, or that human heart comprehend his fathomless mystery. He is and hath ever been veiled in the ancient eternity of his essence, and will remain in his reality everlastingly hidden from the sight of men. He standeth exalted beyond and above all separation and union, all proximity and remoteness. No sign can indicate his presence or his absence, inasmuch as by a word of his command, all that are in heaven and on earth have come to exist, and by his wish, which is the primal will itself, all have stepped out of utter nothingness into the realm of being, the world of the visible. All the prophets of God and their chosen ones, all the divines, the sages, and the wise of every generation unanimously recognize their inability to attain unto the comprehension of that quintessence of all truth, and confess their incapacity to grasp him who is the inmost reality of all things. End quote. The station and nature of the manifestation of God are exalted above the world of humanity. He is in truth the embodiment of God's attributes revealed to man. He is the source of all the spiritual energies which are released from age to age. Just as the sun is the source of life and energy to this earth, so the manifestation of God is the sun to mankind. The life, growth, and progress of humanity or do and depend upon the appearance of these heavenly souls. Baha'u'llah extols the station of the manifestations of God and reveals a measure of their glory in these words. Quote, "The door of the knowledge of the Ancient of Days, being thus closed in the face of all beings, the source of infinite grace, according to his saying, His grace hath transcended all things. My grace encompassed them all, hath caused those luminous gems of holiness to appear out of the realm of the spirit, in the noble form of the human temple, and be made manifest unto all men, that they may impart unto the world the mysteries of the unchangeable being, and tell of the subtleties of his imperishable essence. These sanctified mirrors, these daysprings of ancient glory, are one and all the exponents on earth of him who is the central orb of the universe, its essence and ultimate purpose. From him proceed their knowledge and power. From him is derived their sovereignty. The beauty of their countenance is but a reflection of his image, and their revelation a sign of his deathless glory. They are the treasuries of divine knowledge and the repositories of celestial wisdom. Through them is transmitted a grace that is infinite, and by them is revealed the light that can never fade, even as he hath said. There is no distinction whatsoever between thee and them, except that they are thy servants and are created of thee. This is the significance of the tradition, I am he himself, and he is I myself." End quote. And again he reveals the following, quote, "And of all men, the most accomplished, the most distinguished, and the most excellent are the manifestations of the Son of Truth. Nay, all else besides these manifestations live by the operation of their will, and move and have their being through the outpourings of their grace. But for thee, I would have not created the heavens. Nay, all in their holy presence fade into utter nothingness, and are a thing forgotten. Human tongue can never befittingly sing their praise, and human speech can never unfold their mystery. These tabernacles of holiness, these primal mirrors which reflect the light of unfading glory, are but expressions of him who is the invisible of the invisibles. By the revelation of these gems of divine virtue, all the names and attributes of God, such as knowledge and power, sovereignty and dominion, mercy and wisdom, glory, bounty and grace, are made manifest." End quote.
There are two passages in the Kitab-e-Iqan which appear to be contradictory. One speaks of the unity of the messengers of God, the other exalts some above others. Baha'u'llah quotes these and explains the oneness of the manifestations of God on the one hand and their differences on the other. Of their unity, he states, quote, "Furthermore, it is evident to thee that the bearers of the trust of God are made manifest unto the peoples of the earth as the exponents of a new cause and the bearers of a new message, inasmuch as these birds of the celestial throne are all sent down from the heaven of the will of God, and as they all arise to proclaim his irresistible faith, they therefore are regarded as one soul and the same person. These manifestations of God have each a twofold station. One is the station of pure abstraction and essential unity, In this respect, if thou callest them all by one name, and dost ascribe to them the same attribute, thou hast not erred from the truth. Even as he hath revealed, no distinction do we make between any of his messengers. For they one and all summon the people of the earth to acknowledge the unity of God, and herald unto them the Kohasar of an infinite grace and bounty. They are all invested with the robe of prophethood, and honored with the mantle of glory. It is clear and evident to thee that all the prophets are the temples of the cause of God, who have appeared clothed in diverse attire. If thou wilt observe with discriminating eyes, thou wilt behold them all abiding in the same tabernacle, soaring in the same heaven, seated upon the same throne, uttering the same speech, and proclaiming the same faith. Such is the unity of these essences of being, those luminaries of infinite and immeasurable splendor. Wherefore should one of these manifestations of holiness proclaim, saying, I am the return of all the prophets, he verily speaketh the truth. In like manner, in every subsequent revelation, the return of the former revelation is a fact, the truth of which is firmly established. End quote. Then speaking of the differences which distinguish the manifestations of God, Baha'u'llah explains, quote, In this respect, each manifestation of God hath a distinct individuality, a definitely prescribed mission, a predestined revelation, and specially designated limitations. Each one of them is known by a different name, is characterized by a special attribute, fulfills a definite mission, and is entrusted with a particular revelation. Even as he saith, Some of the apostles we have caused to excel the others. To some God hath spoken, some he hath raised and exalted, and to Jesus, Son of Mary, we gave manifest signs, and we strengthened him with the Holy Spirit. It is because of this difference in their station and mission that the words and utterances flowing from these wellsprings of divine knowledge appear to diverge and differ. Otherwise, in the eyes of them that are initiated into the mysteries of divine wisdom, all their utterances are in reality but the expressions of one truth. End quote. Just as the reality of each manifestation of God is the same as that of former manifestations, so their followers are likewise the return of the essence of the followers of former dispensations. In this connection, Baha'u'llah uses the following analogy. Quote, Consider the rose. Whether it blossometh in the east or in the west, it is nonetheless a rose. For what mattereth in this respect is not the outward shape and form of the rose, but rather the smell and fragrance which it doth impart. End quote. As already indicated, the manifestation of God has a dual nature, divine and human. Baha'u'llah's explanation is illuminating. Quote, Thus, viewed from the standpoint of their oneness and sublime detachment, the attributes of Godhead, divinity, supreme singleness, and inmost essence have been and are applicable to those essences of being, inasmuch as they all abide on the throne of divine revelation and are established upon the seat of divine concealment. Through their appearance, the revelation of God is made manifest, and by their countenance the beauty of God is revealed. Thus it is that the accents of God himself have been heard, uttered by these manifestations of the divine being. Viewed in the light of their second station, the station of distinction, differentiation, temporal limitations, characteristics, and standards, they manifest absolute servitude, utter destitution and complete self-effacement. Even as he saith, I am the servant of God, I am but a man like you. Were any of the all-embracing manifestations of God to declare, I am God, he verily speaketh the truth, and no doubt attacheth thereto. For it hath been repeatedly demonstrated that through their revelation, their attributes and names, the revelation of God, his name, and his attributes are made manifest in the world. And were they to say, we are the servants of God, this also is a manifest and indisputable fact. For they have been made manifest in the uttermost state of servitude, a servitude the like of which no man can possibly attain. End quote.
The sovereignty of the prophets. One of the questions which Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad asked Baha'u'llah to resolve for him concerned the circumstances of the appearance of the Qa'im. According to the traditions of Islam, he is to come with great sovereignty and rule over the people. These conditions were not literally fulfilled by the Bab. Baha'u'llah devotes a considerable part of the Kitab-e-Iqan to his reply demonstrating that all the prophets of God have appeared with majesty and power, but that these were spiritual conditions rather than physical. Their sovereignty was heavenly, and through it they established their ascendancy and lordship over mankind. Speaking of the sovereignty of the Qa'im, he writes, quote, this sovereignty, however, is not the sovereignty which is the minds of men have falsely imagined. Moreover, the prophets of old, each and every one, whenever announcing to the people of their day the advent of the coming revelation, have invariably and specifically referred to that sovereignty with which the promised manifestation must needs be invested. This is attested by the records of the scriptures of the past. This sovereignty had not been solely and exclusively attributed to the Qa'im. Nay, rather, the attributes of sovereignty and all other names and attributes of God have been and will ever be vouchsafed unto all the manifestations of God before and after him, inasmuch as these manifestations, as it had already been explained, are the embodiments of the attributes of God the invisible, and the revealers of the divine mysteries. Furthermore, by sovereignty it is meant the all-encompassing, all-pervading power which is inherently exercised by the Qa'im, whether or not he appear to the world clothed in the majesty of earthly dominion. This is solely dependent upon the will and pleasure of the Qa'im himself. You will readily recognize that the terms sovereignty, wealth, life, death, judgment, and resurrection spoken by the scriptures of the old are not what this generation had conceived and vainly imagined. Nay, by sovereignty is meant that sovereignty which in every dispensation resideth within and is exercised by the person of the manifestation, the day star of truth. That sovereignty is the spiritual ascendancy which he exerciseth to the fullest degree over all that is in heaven and on earth, and which in due time revealeth itself to the world in direct proportion to its capacity and spiritual receptiveness. End quote. Comparing the ascendancy and creative power of the manifestations of God with the fleeting sovereignty of earthly kings, Baha'u'llah states, quote, "Be fair is this sovereignty which, through the utterance of one word, had manifested such pervading influence, ascendancy, and awful majesty. Is this sovereignty superior? Or is the worldly dominion of these kings of earth who, despite their solicitude for their subjects and their help of the poor, are assured only of an outward and fleeting allegiance, while in the hearts of men they inspire neither affection nor respect? Had not that sovereignty through the potency of one word subdued, quickened, and revitalized the whole world? What can the lowly dust compare with him who is the Lord of Lords? What tongue dare utter the immensity of difference that lieth between them? Nay, all comparison falleth short in attaining the hallowed sanctuary of his sovereignty. Were man to reflect, he would surely perceive that even the servant of his threshold ruleth over all created things. This had already been witnessed and will in future be made manifest." End quote. Among other stories which Baha'u'llah recounts to demonstrate the meaning of the sovereignty and dominion attributed to the prophets of God is that of Jesus during his captivity in the hands of the Jews. Quote, "Similarly called out to mind the day when the Jews who had surrounded Jesus, son of Mary, were pressing him to confess his claim of being the Messiah and prophet of God, so that they might declare him an infidel and sentence him to death. Then they led him away, he who was the day star of the heaven of divine revelation, and to Pilate and Caiaphas, who was the leading divine of that age. The chief priests were all assembled in the palace, also a multitude of people who had gathered to witness his suffering, to deride and injure him. Though they repeatedly questioned him, hoping that he would confess his claim, yet Jesus held his peace and spoke not. Finally, an accursed of God arose, and approaching Jesus, adjured him, saying, 'Didst thou not claim to be the divine Messiah? Didst thou not say, I am the King of Kings, my word is the word of God, and I am the breaker of the Sabbath day?' Thereupon, Jesus lifted up his head and said, 'Beholdest thou not the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and might?' These were his words. And yet consider how, to outward seeming, he was devoid of all power, except that inner power, which was of God and which had encompassed all that is in heaven and on earth." End quote. In the course of his exposition of sovereignty, Baha'u'llah dwells on the sufferings which were heaped upon the prophets of God and his chosen ones. He describes the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, which shed a glorious luster upon the faith of Islam. He also portrays the sufferings and the tribulations which were inflicted upon Muhammad during the earlier years of his ministry. In this connection, Baha'u'llah demonstrates that the words spoken by the manifestation transport the human soul from a state of wretchedness and ignorance into the glorious realm of divine virtues and perfections. Through the potency of his revelation, he welds the hearts of contending peoples and kindreds and makes of them a single nation. And he shows the relevance of a well-known biblical prophecy. Quote, "Furthermore, how numerous are those peoples of diverse beliefs, conflicting creeds, and opposing temperaments who, through the reviving fragrance of divine springtime, breathing from the Rizwan of God, have been arrayed with the new robe of divine unity and have drunk from the cup of his singleness. This is the significance of the well-known words, the wolf and the lamb shall feed together. Behold the ignorance and folly of those who, like the nations of old, are still expecting to witness the time when these beasts will feed together in one pasture. Such is their low estate. Methinks, never have their lips touched the cup of understanding, neither have their feet trodden the path of justice. Besides, of what profit would it be to the world were such a thing to take place? How well had he spoken concerning them? Hearts have they, with which they understand not, and eyes have they, with which they see not." End quote.